Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Today I'm joined by Lee Kravitz, who talks about his debut novel, The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. Lee had a long career in the publishing industry and talks about what he learned. He also shares why getting a degree in psychology may have been more useful than an MFA. We also hear how John Truby saved Lee's writing, the importance of putting your shoes on, and so much more. Enjoy the conversation. Lee Kravitz, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. We're super happy to be here.
So maybe as a segue to introducing the novel, we can talk about the transition from nonfiction to fiction, because your prior work was in the realm of kind of scientific journalism, sort of Malcolm Gladwell-esque sociological studies. Mm-hmm. And I can see, I'm not going to give anything away, but I can see where Strange Contagion might have led to this, but I'm going to let you guide that discussion and see how that transition came.
Well, thank you. So I think my nonfiction work, you know, I was trained as a journalist. I went to journalism school in college. And, you know, obviously I worked at PBS for a long time, but a lot of Strange Contagion was incredibly narrative driven. And I think all of my nonfiction work, you know, leading up to my first book was all narrative driven. It's all about stories. And I always sort of, I don't know if I was taught this or it just sort of made sense to me that if you're able to sort of show some really complicated scientific stuff, but in story, it sticks better. And it's more sort of amazing to sort of understand, you know, to watch and see unfold, right? If it's in narrative. So, you know, I sort of tell these stories about this small town in Northern California that's dealing with the trauma. And I sort of show how the town comes together and uses principles of positive psychology to sort of bounce forward after catastrophic tragedy and trauma. But it was very, very much when I was finished with that book, it felt very narrative driven. It felt almost, if it weren't real, it could have been fiction. I mean, that's sort of where I was going. And I decided writing fiction was sort of the next logical leap. And to be fair, and honest, I'd actually always wanted to write fiction. To my agent's sort of chagrin, I called my agent right after Strange Contagion came out. And he was like, okay, Lee, so what are you doing next? You know, what book are you cooking up? And I said, you know, I'm actually, you know, I'm thinking about not doing nonfiction. And he stopped me cold. And he said, listen, Lee, I got to tell you, I hope you're not going to say you're going to do a novel next. And I said, why? And he goes, because every nonfiction writer wants to be a novelist. And so I sort of laughed and also got really scared. And I was like, well, I'm thinking about becoming a novelist. And he said, okay, man, well, look, do what you got to do. But let me be the judge and I'll see what we can do. So I said, okay, fine. So I started writing. I wrote the first draft of what became The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. And I sent it to him and he called me up and there was this sort of kind of terrifying moment of silence on the other end. And he goes, Lee, this is going to be your first novel. And that was sort of it. And I never looked back. I don't think I can go back to nonfiction after this.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, I don't think I love can. It. So tell me about this. How did you settle on Sylvia? She's such an enduring character and we can get into all that, but tell me about how you found her and what inspired this.
So, you know, I think most people have encountered Sylvia Plath in their lives. She's always sort of been there. I can't actually pinpoint the moment where she sort of made an appearance. It was like, you know, she's always been there, but I was 30 years old and I've been trying to become a writer and I couldn't figure out how to do it. So I decided I'm just going to go back to grad school and I'll become a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did at 30. I went back to grad school. I found myself during that time working at a mental hospital in Palo Alto or Menlo Park, actually. And it turns out it's the exact same mental hospital that Ken Kesey worked at when he was inspired and actually started writing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Mm-hmm. He's actually in the building right next door to that building. That building had been shut down. But you can almost imagine it. If you've seen the movie, it looks just like the hospital ward in the movie. And the one I was in was a little bit more updated. By that, I mean, it looked like it had been built in the 1970s and hadn't changed. And there's a book kiosk for all the patients because there's not a lot to do in a mental hospital. And I wound up picking up The Bell Jar, actually. Mm-hmm. And I was really surprised to see it there and also pleasantly surprised to see it there. Yeah. So here I am. I'm reading it and it dawns on me as I'm reading it, that what I'm really reading is sort of a parallel story. It's a parallel story, not just of Sylvia Plath's, you know, sort of thinly veiled experience in a mental hospital in 1952, but it's also the, you know, story of the birth of confessional poetry. which wound up not coming to fruition like in a university town or during times of peril or strife or in like these sort of blooms of sort of creative exploration, but actually in mental hospitals. You have Sylvia Plath in a mental hospital. You have Robert Lowell in a mental hospital. You have Anne Sexton in a mental hospital. And all of these take place, all of their poems that sort of that launch this movement are born inside these walls. And I was like, you know, that is the story that I really want to tell. I really want to dig as deep as I can into this story and also see where that story sort of takes me. And then, of course, all roads led to Sylvia Plath.
It's so funny to me that they would have a copy of The Bell Jar in a mental hospital, which I guess is like a testament to how far mental health has come in the last 50 or 60 years, because I feel like they wouldn't have had that there, right?
At all. In fact, the fact that it was there at all was sort of like a major surprise. I mean, usually what you see in these sort of in these hospital wards are you're going to have, you know, Stephen King novels or Dean Koontz novels or sort of Brad Thor novels or, you know, things like that, that are sort of, you know, to sort of take you away from where you're at and sort of entertain you while they sort of fill you with drugs. And, you know, the psychiatrist comes and checks on you, you know, twice a day. That's pretty much what it is. But there it was. And so part of me thinks somebody brought it in and left it there. But the beautiful part is nobody took it away. It's been there and it's been used. It was a worn paperback copy. I put it back after I read it. It's probably still there.
So these three, Robert Lowell is in the book, and we can get to how he's in the book. Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton is a character who's kind of transformed into another character. But They all studied in the same poetry workshop. And they did they also circulate around this same mental institution? They were in the same spot?
So Robert Lowell never actually wound up at McLean Hospital. McLean Hospital is actually still there. It almost looks like the original building looked almost like a university. It was, you know, the brick, you know, sort of almost castle-like structure. And it's right outside of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sylvia did go there. She calls it something different in The Bell Jar, but it's essentially that's where she was. Robert Lowell was actually hospitalized in multiple places, you know, Boston hospitals, New York was another one. Anne Sexton never went to McLean, but she did wind up in a number of Boston area mental hospitals. And she was there for off and on for many times in her life. So, you know, for this novel, I wanted everything to sort of circulate, you know, around a singular space. So, you know, obviously Sylvia goes to McLean Hospital. Robert Lowell makes an appearance there and plays a key role in Sylvia's sort of growth from that place. And the character of Anne Sexton is actually turned into a different character, which you referenced, named Boston Rhodes. So Boston is both, I guess, sort of a simulacrum of Anne Sexton, but also she's much, much more. And so she does make an appearance off and on in the area, but not at McLean Hospital specifically.
Okay. So we should introduce sort of the structure and characters of the book. So the book is told from three different points of view, never Sylvia or Robert. So I want to talk about that too, because that's interesting. But these three different points of view, which is a present day curator who has discovered these manuscripts of Sylvia Plath, Boston Rhodes, who, as we've alluded to, is sort of based upon, but much bigger than Anne Sexton, or much more complicated. Well, I shouldn't say
that. Well, but definitely, I think you're right. I hope so.
Yes. And the psychiatrist who treated Sylvia Plath when she was at McLean. So tell me a little bit about choosing these three really complicated points of view. They're all women. They're all across kind of different time periods. And, you know, their stories intersect, but those sound like challenging points of view to take on. So tell me a little bit about choosing them and how they were going to be the catalyst for the story.
Sure. It's a great question. So since we're getting into the nuts and bolts of writing, I knew that I wanted to explore the different ways that Sylvia Plath and confessional poetry in particular influenced the people around her. And so Sylvia, I knew, was never going to be the central point of view of the novel. I really wanted it to come, I wanted the book to sort of come at the subject matter from the point of view of people who were affected by her and who in turn affected her. So we're looking at variations of theme. And so I was like, okay, well, let's look at what creativity can do. And so with Dr. Ruth Barnhouse, who is sort of the, you know, we were introduced to her right as, you know, Sylvia is brought into McLean Hospital. She is the first female psychiatrist in New England and possibly even the country. And she comes in and, of course, she's sort of a rebel rouser. She's bringing in all these sort of new techniques to psychology and psychotherapy and psych techniques and things like that. And she's not an artist at all. But then she encounters a young Sylvia Plath, who is very much something different. And she sort of helps Sylvia come into herself by introducing her to the therapeutic sort of nature of writing. And so there was that. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to look into some, you know, look at it from the point of view of somebody who was affected by Sylvia's poetry, but was instead of being inspired by it, but was instead sort of challenged by it and very much becomes a rival to Sylvia's talent. And so that's where Boston Rhodes comes in. She's a character who meets Sylvia Plath in Robert Lowell's sort of famous poetry workshop at Boston University. And Boston is immensely talented and is really in line for the throne of what will become confessional poetry, that whole movement, until Sylvia Plath comes in. And Sylvia both pushes her and makes her poetry better, but it also sort of sends Boston Rhodes into a tailspin. And so that's, I knew that that's where that storyline needed to come in. And then you have this third storyline, which is sort of the lay reader, somebody who discovers Sylvia Plath after the fact and discovers not only is she a magnificent writer, but that her poetry, even 60 years after the fact, still resonates and can change her life dramatically. And that character was actually me, because before I started writing about Sylvia Plath, I knew who Sylvia Plath was. I know she was a beautiful writer, but I didn't know much about her. And the deeper I dug, the more I felt a connection to her and wanted to learn more. And by the end, I feel like our relationship is one of, I can't even put my finger on it. It just feels, I feel very close to her. And, the reality is I never met her. I've just read her the way that the modern day curator reads her and finds something really special in that relationship. So that's where the three point of views came from. And they all tell a different story and a different perspective about Sylvia Plath.
So it's a wonderful amalgam of truth and fiction, and certain things did happen. A lot of these things did happen. And then there's a leap into imagination. And so Tell me about that process of getting to know these people and how much research you did on the front end. And then when you felt comfortable taking the leap into the fictive realm.
Yeah. So, I started out, probably a year before I started really writing, just reading everything I could get on Sylvia Plath. And actually it was, I discovered The Bell Jar again, and then I started reading all of her journals. And what's amazing is that, so many of her writings, so many of her journals, her letters are preserved. And you can read them. You can read read them online. You can read all the books. And I just dug deep. So I read everything I could possibly get. I wanted to be able to understand her voice and her tone, even though I wasn't really going to be, coming at it from her point of view. I knew that she was going to be in the book. And if I was going to put Sylvia Plath in the book, I needed to get her tone, her cadence, her state of mind just right. Otherwise, it just wouldn't have been right at all. So I got as close as I possibly could. After I did that, I read everything I possibly could about Anne Sexton. And at one point, Anne was going to be a real character in the book, and she was going to make a real presence, be a real person in the book. But at some point, I realized that this rival character was just so awful. And she wound up taking it not just to where in real life Anne and Sylvia took it, because they were actually rivals and friends in real life. When you look at their poetry at the time when they were classmates together in the workshop, soon after, Sylvia writes a whole suite of poems about bees and beekeepers. And then Anne Sexton does the exact same thing, right? So they're sort of, going back and forth, and they're talking to each other, but not really. And Sylvia even writes a poem called The Rival. So that's real. If you look at Anne Sexton's work, you can kind of see that. I think that they're talking to each other in each other's poems and in their works. And even when they didn't live near each other, Sylvia left Boston soon after that workshop, but they still stayed close. And they did sort of speak to each other in rhyme and in poems. But Boston Rhodes, the character Boston Rhodes, needed to go farther than Anne Sexton could. And so she does. And she takes it pretty far. And so I knew that once I let go of Anne Sexton as a character, the novel could come to life. And it was at that point that I realized I actually had something that was a story worth telling.
So we should say that the novel is broken up into these 9 stanzas. And in each stanza, each woman has a chance to tell their story, but each one opens with sort of a quote from Boston Rhodes, either from an excerpt from a poem or an interview or an essay. So it occurred to me, because they're so poetic, they're so beautiful, her little snippets there, that I looked them up saying, I wonder if he drew these from Anne Sexton, but I think you wrote those yourself.
Whole plot. Somebody asked me in an interview last week, were you a poet before you started writing about poetry? And I'm like, I'm not a poet at all. I don't consider myself a poet in any way, shape, or form. In fact, as I was reading and doing the research for this, I actually learned as much as I could about poetry because I found it fascinating. I read the work of Matthew Zapruder, who writes a ton about poetry, and anything I can get my hands on specifically about confessional poetry, but also the poetry of those contemporaries and their contemporaries. But when I started getting into the skin of Boston Rhodes, it's almost like you become a character actor in some ways, or I should say better yet, you become a method actor. You get into the cadence of the character's voice and her thinking. And actually on my phone, I hope nobody ever discovers these, I actually have audio clips of me sort of just riffing in her voice. And at some point you realize that there has to be poetry. You have to show it. And when I started writing the works of, of Boston Rhodes, it just sort of came naturally. Like, I understood her point of view. I understood what she wanted to say, and I understood how she would say it. And then all of a sudden, there's these poems on the page. And it was very much sort of a special sort of process. To this day, I couldn't sit down and write a poem today. But if you asked me to write a poem through the voice and the mind and the eyes of Boston Rhodes, I could probably do it.
Or a line of poetry.
A line of poetry, exactly. Because, I mean, yeah, I think doing a full poem, I don't think I have the talent for that. But, I could jump in and out.
We should do a little sidebar here on confessional poetry for people who don't know that whole movement. And I think it's interesting, A, that the novel is released during Women's History Month, and kind of the role that Sylvia Plath may have played in the feminist movement that was really just kind of burgeoning when she died. But talk a little bit about what this confessional poetry movement means and was, and sort of setting it in time. It's a tricky time. And I think especially a tricky time for a white man from 2022 to write about women in the 1950s, right?
I know. I'm either going to get completely destroyed or maybe I'll contribute to the conversation in some way. I think, you're making such great points. And these questions are great, legitimate questions to ask. First of all, let's go to the major question that I even had. Here I am. I'm in my early 40s. I'm writing a book about Sylvia Plath from the perspective of three different women. How are you going to pull this off, right? Or, how can you? Part of it was, it's a delicate question. It's a delicate process. It's a conversation point that I think is, we need to have as creatives. Like, are we allowed to write? And if so, how are we allowed to portray what we want to write about or, paint or write poetry about or you name it, right? But more than that, like when I was writing this, I didn't really come at it from the perspective of, a male writing about women. I was really coming at it from the perspective of almost like a psychologist, which is sort of my background, and looking at how art affects different people in different ways. And the fact that each of the characters is a woman made it all the more richer for me. And it just sort of made sense. And I did play with the novel in different ways, trying to see if I could bring in male characters' point of views, because I actually thought that was would have been a really interesting way to go as well. But by the end, it just didn't make sense. And when I landed on all three of them, these characters just sort of, were three-dimensional and they each had something to say. So I followed that lead and hopefully it sort of comes through well in the finished product. But confessional poetry, right? Confessional poetry, when you think about poetry today, you think about poetry that's raw and personal and talks about thoughts and feelings and sometimes really unethical behaviors. But before the mid-1950s, poetry wasn't like that. Poetry was about nature. It was about sometimes political movements. It was about ideology. It was about the world around us, but it was rarely about the world within us. And what Sylvia did, along with her contemporaries, was write about these things that nobody ever talked about. And you weren't really ever supposed to talk about. You're not supposed to talk about depression. You're not supposed to talk about mania. You're not supposed to talk about abortion or masturbation or being hospitalized, you're not even supposed to talk about the mundane little things around us that bring us to places of grief, you know, and Sylvia did that so well. Anne Sexton did that beautifully. Robert Lowell, oh my gosh, his stuff was, I mean, just incredible. Snodgrass's work was incredible. You can go on and on. And the effect that this had on poetry and on art moving forward was tremendous. We wouldn't have, I'm sure we wouldn't have grunge music if confessional poetry weren't around. We wouldn't have memoir the way that we know it today if Sylvia Plath hadn't done what she'd done. Literature today would not be nearly as real and as raw if it weren't for, you know, the people like Sylvia Plath who came out with this confessional poetry, which was, by the way, at the time, looked down upon by many, many people.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting to set it in time and see what that did to women. You know, I mean, this is pre Roe v. Wade. It's, you know, just as the pill is gaining momentum. It's, yeah, and it was sort of this women finding their voice and finding a way to talk about what their experiences were, which nobody really wanted to hear.
I think that's true. And I mean, what wonderful character to draw from, right? When you think about people who are shouting from the rooftops about how they think and feel and all the things that they're angry about, you don't think about, you know, the stereotypical 1950s housewife. You think about, you know, angry teenagers, you know, like my preteens who come out and scream and shout all the time. No, it's actually, it comes from these quiet little houses and these quiet little rooms, which in reality were never quiet. And Sylvia, my character, Boston Rhodes, these two characters in particular wind up just shattering as many of those sort of walls as they possibly can. And there's so many people that listen to and, you know, just their words resonate with and they've carried throughout time. And I was like, you know, that's something that we should look into. So the reason that the novel split up into three different eras is it's almost like a ripple. You're going to see how Sylvia starts out and you're going to see how this ripple starts to shake things 10 years down the line, 15, 20, 25 years down the line as well.
Is it the case that two of her, I read somewhere that two of her poems, unknown poems, were discovered not that long ago, like 2017 or something?
You know, I'd heard that. Her poems keep on popping up. You'll get original drafts of very well-known poems show up at auction. A couple of years ago, I believe you're right, that there were a couple of poems that had not been discovered before that were sort of brought out to auction. Fairly recently, Sylvia's daughter put all of her parents, you know, objects from the house, even their wedding rings, out for auction. And obviously, people are just going to kind of collect these and hold on to these and want to hold on to them as close as they can because they feel such affinity and connection to Sylvia. One of the questions I've always had is, you know, are we allowed to actually own her or a perception of her? And what is our obligation to the artist, you know, once she gives her work to the world? I mean, people really, really feel quite possessive of her. And in other ways, they feel like they want to, you know, sort of take care of her legacy and her memory as well, which is really hard to do because, you know, it's very hard to sort of pin her down. She had so many different sides of her. She was more than three-dimensional in my mind. I think she was five-dimensional. And we only see two dimensions. I mean, that's how complex she was as a person.
Well, your point is really getting to the DNA of the whole novel, which is, do we have a right to own her? Who has a right to kind of possess her? I was thinking what a terrible guest she'd make on this show because you portray her as a woman who really wanted to hide her process. And, you know, that's all we talk about. So I was like, well, good. Sylvia didn't get to come on the show.
Oh, that's, you know, what's so interesting. She was very secretive of her process. She never wanted to talk about her process. And yet she maintained a relationship with a number of poets and a number of people in her lives, including Ruth Barnhouse, her psychiatrist. After she left McLean Hospital, she maintained a really close relationship with her. They wrote letters to each other for over a decade. Occasionally, Sylvia would come in and visit her when she was in town, and she would spend a couple of months in therapy with her. And in one of her final series of letters to Ruth Barnhouse, she was actually going into process in terms of how she was writing The Bell Jar. And those letters are amazing. They reveal a side of Sylvia that she rarely talked about with anybody else. Ruth, I'm writing today to tell you that I am now on chapter 5 of this novel. It is flowing through me. It is coming together in a way that I never expected it would. I cannot wait to tell you more about it in my next letter. And then a month later, there's another letter you know, saying pretty much the same thing. I've ripped through chapters 5 through 10. I have 2 more chapters to go. I think you're really going to like it. So she goes into process that way. And if you go even deeper, the bell jar is about her process. Mm. It's all about her process. It's about the way that she sort of sees the world and tries to explain it. And when she can't, she loses her mind. And then she slowly builds it back up again. And that is her literary process. So that was, again, when I discovered the bell jar, it's multidimensional. It goes very, very deep, and it tells multiple parallel stories at once, including her process.
So when you had this much information about her and about how complex she was and how complex the bell jar was, but you had this central question in your mind, as you said, about what right do we have to own her? How much are we allowed to possess her? Mm-hmm. Tell me about what was driving the engine of the novel all the way through for you. Did you have that question that you set out to answer for yourself, and this novel was an answer to that? Or did you discover that question kind of along the path of writing it?
It was along the way. It was along the way. I was really curious about how Sylvia Plath became Sylvia Plath. That was really the sort of thing that really drove me throughout. It was obviously the people around her who influenced her, and I wanted to know who they were. And I wanted to sort of uncover who Sylvia was in a way that very few got to know her. I think so there was a little bit of selfishness on my part, just curiosity. And to be honest, the modern storyline, the engine that drives the novel, you know, the mystery of, you know, these sort of manuscripts that show up in the modern day curator's sort of possession, all of a sudden I started asking questions. I was just curious, like, you know, do we ever really know the artist behind the piece? How much are we allowed to own that experience? Is it a personal experience? When we, you know, obviously reading her work is very personal, but there also seems to be this sort of universal sort of collective possession of Sylvia and her work. And people go to extreme lengths to not just know her, but get to know her, to be closer to her, to claim her. And so that becomes a very physical sort of, you know, drive for the book, for the characters within the book. Items go up for auction, and people will spend millions of dollars on these items, only for them to be put into private collections and disappear from the world forever. And so, you know, I think my character, you know, the curator really does grapple with the idea of possession, which again is actually, you know, really what Sylvia and Boston Rhodes were sort of experiencing in real time in the 1950s and 60s. You know, people who wanted to possess the identity of women and put them in certain rooms and boxes that, you know, we sort of talk about in the novel as well. And it's about them sort of busting out. And so the modern story, it had to be a female character, because she's ultimately going to, you know, sort of bust out of those rooms as well.
My guest this morning is Lee Kravitz. The book we're talking about is The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. You're listening to Writers on Writing. It's funny to talk about possession. I feel like you never know how much an author is possessed until you go visit their headstone.
Oh my God.
You can see how many people. And I was just looking at all these images of her headstone, of people trying to take the Hughes name off of her headstone. And at some point people took the Plath name off of her headstone, but there, and yeah. You know, there's all this homage to her there, but yeah, I feel like it's, you can tell how alive someone is by how many times people are visiting them.
You know, it's true. It's totally true. I mean, think about it. Ted Hughes, I think, got a bum rap when it comes to what happened to Sylvia. You know, if you look at the history, many people widely considered Ted Hughes to be the reason Sylvia died by suicide. I just don't think that's true. I think that it could have been anything, because, you know, one of the themes of the novel is mental illness. And there's this idea that when somebody goes into a mental hospital or for treatment, that we can cure them of, you know, bipolar disorder, or at that time it was called manic depression. But the reality is we don't. You know, mental illness is part of who we are as humans. You know, everybody feels grief or anxiety or depression, and sometimes it's even more. And we don't really cure that. We treat it. Sometimes it opens up windows of calm. But the reality is we can't actually contain it. we can't really, really treat it. It's always going to be there. And so when Sylvia decided to take her life, what had happened was Ted had famously had a series of affairs. They had separated. Sylvia's children were really sick with bad colds. It was a terrible, terrible winter. She was isolated in another country, away from the people that she knew from home. And she was spiraling. You can read her letters to Ruth Barnhouse about that period of time. She was genuinely spiraling. It was all of these things and none of these things that led Sylvia to take her life. It was the mental illness that really did it. But Ted Hughes got the brunt of it. He was called murderer. He was widely condemned for being the reason that the world doesn't have Sylvia anymore. And I just don't think that that's true. So in the novel, I really try to portray Ted as more of a goof in some ways. Somebody who doesn't even know what's really going on. He seems almost aloof to everything in the world except his own needs and desires. So yeah, I think that there's something about that possessiveness, and we just want to assign blame or reason, but I don't think that we can.
Knowing the fate of Anne Sexton as we do, did you come away from this thinking that they recognized something in each other and that's why they were having this kind of conversation through their poetry with each other? Or did you come away thinking it was a bit more like social contagion?
It's a great question. I actually think that they saw a lot of similarity in each other. I mean, the best rivals on the planet, the ones who are the most, famous or notorious rivals, they're rivals because they are so darn similar. Other than just some basic differences, they look the same. They had the same personality, the same smile. They had the same friends. They were naturally drawn to the same kind of poetry. I mean, to think about it, this sort of poetry was so little known, and yet they both were there. I mean, Sylvia was writing confessional poetry years before it was called confessional poetry. And Anne Sexton had never picked up a pen and had never written a single poem until she was 30 years old. And she decided to write a poem based on, I think, a PBS special that she had heard. And she was like, I could do that. And she did. And a year later, she's nominated for major poetry awards. I'm pretty sure the Pulitzer Prize came a couple of years later for her. I mean, it was unbelievable. So the fact that they had the same sort of instinct to write the way that they were writing, and they came at it from places, that in natural ways. It wasn't like they read something like, oh, I can be a confessional poet too. They both came at it naturally. I think that they saw each other as, they were standing in each other's way, but at the same time, they were also sort of elevating each other at the same time and pushing each other. I just thought it was a beautiful, beautiful relationship to sort of explore.
So speaking of the confessional poetry, we should say that Boston Rhodes sections are told in the form of, they're kind of epistolary. They're told in this form of a letter to Professor Lowell. And so you get to play a little bit with second person there, and she is confessing. I mean, it's a big confessional letter. So tell me about settling on that. I don't know if I want to call it a device, but tell me about settling on that epistolary style for her section.
Thank you for asking that. I wanted part of this to be so personal that there would be the second person in some way, right? She says, she addresses Robert Lowell, the letter to Robert Lowell, and it refers to him as you, or, dear professor, but mainly it's you. And so in some ways she's talking directly to the reader, whoever that reader happens to be. For her letters, it's Robert Lowell, her professor, but for us, it's we, the readers. And it got us much, much closer to her. And part of this novel had to be a confession. The whole novel itself spins around the idea of confessions and what confessions are. Obviously, for poetry, it's about confessing our thoughts and feelings, right? But for Boston Rhodes, it becomes a confession of something much, much more, much darker and more honest than I think she could do even in poetry. And so we start to see not just her point of view, but also her madness and the lengths that she will go. And obviously, by the end of the novel, she goes to very, very extreme lengths, without giving anything away. I knew from the very beginning it had to be a letter and it had to be a confession.
And when you're in that voice, do you stay there all. So tell me about switching back and forth between these people and whether this was written very linearly or if you kind of just sat down and wrote Boston section.
It's a wonderful question. With this, I tried doing it linearly and it wouldn't work. It just didn't. The way that the novel's set up, it's almost like clockwork, right? So every scene from the past informs the next scene, which takes place 10 years later, which then has to inform the scene that happens, 50 years later. Yeah. So it was this very complicated balance. That said, I needed to stay in character as I wrote these pieces. So I wrote pretty much each storyline within the same sitting, so to speak. And then I started merging them together. And of course, that's where it gets really, really complicated because then you have to start to piece everything and lay clues in each scene. And it really is this sort of mystery that pushes everything forward, but it has to inform both the past and the future and the present at the same time. So it was incredibly tricky. And there were many, many times where I was like, wow, if I screw up one piece or I change one piece, then the entire novel changes. And going through the process of working on this, you always have sort of a group of readers who helps you out. I had some terrific ones and, people you really have to trust who know what you're doing and get what you're doing. And every once in a while, I'd get like some feedback on a particular plot point. And I'd be like, oh my gosh, this is absolutely right. I have to change it. But then I literally have to go back and change it for every storyline. And that could sometimes take 6 months.
How long did this take?
Start to finish, 3.5 years.
So tell me what your office looks like, because some people do this by little post-it notes that they just have hanging all over the place where they have notes to themselves. Some people have a notebook. Yeah. How did you do this? Because I don't think that we've stressed enough, if people haven't picked up the book yet, it is a mystery. It's a little gem of a mystery. And so the lockbox feature of how these gears have to entwine is complicated.
It is. And the hope is that it comes across really smoothly and simply, when you read the book. But okay, so I have a picture somewhere of little scraps of paper and with little plot points. And I tore them all out and I laid them on this long dining room table that I have. And I sat there and I moved them all around until there must have been 120 different sheets of paper and each one of them had a plot point. In my chaotic brain, it made sense, but if anybody else saw it, it would look like a disaster. And that's where I started. And I took a picture of that. So I had that sort of picture that I could refer to, like, oh, okay, yeah, that sort of goes there. And then I have, I think, 15 different versions of the outline. And I printed them each out and you could see, you can't see this now, but I'm working on some pieces now. But it's a sheet of paper with plot points. And then you just scratch them out as you go and highlight them and change them and add notes. It is a miracle anything actually held together. And so you hold your breath for the first, my process is I work 10 months on the first draft, 10 months on the second draft, 10 months on the third draft. And then I start to look at it as the whole. And then I can go in and like really do a deep dive. Once you get to, until I get to the third draft, 30 weeks in, I don't know if it's going to work. I don't know if it's going to work. And so finally, my office is really just it's like an explosion of paper. And by the end, when it was done and I turned everything in, I went through my office and started cleaning up all these stacks of paper. And it was, you can imagine like five dictionaries, like the width of five dictionaries. And it was that much of all the sort of scrap paper and notes that I've sort of stapled on other notes. And it looked all nice and clean and beautiful. But for the last, 3.5 years, it had been just a complete disaster around my office that, is now nice and compact and, has a book cover now. And it makes a lot of sense. But you want to know what madness is? Come into my office.
50 years from now, people are going to find those papers and put them up for auction. And then,
yeah, I don't know if they'll go nearly as high as Sylvia's. I doubt it, but they're definitely going to look at it and go, you know what? I don't understand this, and just throw it away. in fact, yeah, it's funny. Actually, so the book I'm working on now, I've had little notes around, and my dog got. I have this little puppy dog. My dog came in, and I was trying to figure out what my next book was going to be. I had a couple of options. And my dog came in and actually, this is awful. I was gonna
your dog ate your homework.
But he didn't. He peed all over it.
Oh no,
this is awful. And I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, this is the novel. This is the one I want to do next. This is totally it. So my dog helped me with, you know, in some ways too, sort of, you know, figure out how to write and what to write. So yeah.
The reverse of the dog ate my homework story. That's a good story.
That's exactly it. Yeah. My dog literally pointed to what I should do next.
So I was wondering if there were any, like, I always ask people who base things on fact, if there were any inconvenient truths that came up in their research that they're like, damn, that kind of ruins everything. And I don't know if that came up in the research process where you're like, I'm going to have to figure out how to write around this.
God, you're asking such great questions. I'll tell you, the reason I became a novelist was because when I was doing my nonfiction work, inconvenient truths kept on coming up. That's the truth. And so I'd be telling the story of, you know, this small town dealing with this very scary event. This is with strange contagion. And there was a series of suicides from a single high school in this town. And the town at first hides the truth of the suicides and then tries to address them and then goes through the process of grieving and trying to stop this sort of strange contagion from happening. And so I'd follow these sort of storylines from different characters and real life characters, and I'd want them to do something big, or I'd want them to think something or say something that would sort of add gravitas to this, you know, this particular moment, or gravity to other moments, right? And it just never happened. And sometimes I'd go back and I'd say, you know, I'd even mine for that sort of, you know, that sort of detail, and it wouldn't happen. And so finally I was like, you know what? I think the next book is, it has to be fiction, because my storytelling sense keeps on going the opposite direction of reality, which, you know, if anybody, you know, if you ask anybody who knows me, that's pretty much my MO anyway. I kind of live in that sort of fairy tale world sometimes. But once I let go of Anne Sexton, for instance, and was able to use a composite character to create Boston Rhodes, it fixed that problem completely. Sylvia was always Sylvia, so I always knew who she was. You know, the one thing that I kept on worrying about was that some days, you know, before I finished this book, you know, these manuscripts would actually really appear in real life and be discovered, and then I'd be in trouble. So you're sort of racing against the clock and hoping that no, you know, the reality doesn't really, you know, happen before the fiction can come out. But no, in this case, it was actually, it worked. We worked together pretty well, reality and fiction.
And it's interesting to have written about three. I mean, I would almost call all three of them unreliable narrators.
Yeah,
and that's tricky too, you know, because you have to talk around all of their own motivations that are both hidden and not hidden.
I love unreliable narrators. So here's the truth. In my mind, when we're talking about craft, every character is an unreliable narrator. I think that term is, you know, we use that for, like, you know, when we're talking about characters who are clearly mentally ill or potentially, you know, or well-known liars or something like that. But the best thing about, you know, a true, you know, sort of narrative is that it is, I mean, every character is an unreliable narrator because we're seeing it through the lens of their reality. In every character that I try to create, and the characters that I'm always drawn to are literally ones who are damaged in some way. And I'm not talking damaged by trauma. I mean, sometimes even physically damaged. You know, there was a John Irving novel that came out a couple of years ago called The Fourth Hand. The best thing that happened in that novel is the main character gets his hand bitten off by a lion in the opening of the book. And I'm like, that just made the character so wonderful. I go back to John Irving. I mean, A Prayer for Owen Meany. You know, the primary character in that novel is somebody who's very short, very small guy. What an amazing quirk. What an amazing sort of character who's just somewhat different in some ways. And if you're seeing the world through that character's eyes, although you're seeing it through a different character, watching that character, but even still, you're seeing it through sort of a skewed narrative. And to the extent that I can say this, the role of the author is to convey the truth even within that false sort of world that the main character creates for himself or herself. I love that. So I saw it as a huge, huge opportunity. I knew I was onto the right characters when I found the characters who were the most flawed. Because to me, the most flawed characters are the ones who are the most interesting characters.
And yet you were really able to give, so Sylvia Plath, Ted Hughes, and Professor Lowell, never kind of get their say, but they do, you know, I mean, they, you do get to hear them. And so you do get to experience kind of the characters who are the big life characters off stage, but very much on stage. And I thought you handled that really well.
Thank you. You know, I felt like Ted Hughes, Robert Lowell, even Sylvia Plath, everybody gives them a stage. Hmm. Everybody does. But it's the people around them that are affected most by them who I think are even more interesting. You know, the characters who aren't usually given their point of view moment. That's what I was interested in exploring, because, I mean, it wouldn't have been as challenging to write from the point of view of Ted Hughes, although he is a very complex human being. Or Robert Lowell, I don't think it would have been that challenging, because all I would have to do, all anybody would have to do, is pick up their memoirs or pick up their biographies, and it's all there on the page. So for me, and maybe I'm, you know, just as part of the creative process, and part of it was just, you know, what I enjoyed was actually being able to dive into characters who really weren't real, but who had a really wonderful story to tell because of these other characters in their lives.
One of my favorite sections, for some reason, are these, and it's true, are these bees. So Dr. Ruth brings an apiary onto the mental health grounds and uses them as kind of therapy. And at the time, before I knew that was reality, I was like, what an interesting choice. And then I realized, and I was like, wow, what a gift that is to the writer to be able to have this metaphoric bees and these crazy situations with the bees. And I don't know if there were things that, like that you stumbled upon beyond the bees that were great discoveries.
So, you know what? So Ruth Barnhouse shows up at McLean Hospital in the 1950s. And at this time, there's a major split in how psychiatry is sort of performed. You have the Freudians, you know, the ones who are just, you know, they hew very closely to the texts and the techniques of Sigmund Freud. And then you've got people like Ruth Barnhouse who come in, who skew way away from that sort of analytic approach. And they do things that are experiential. And that's what I wanted to show with Ruth Barnhouse. So what Ruth does is she takes these patients out of the hospital and she shows them ways toward mental healing using sort of these experiences that are outside of the classic, you know, sort of, you know, room with the couch and the, you know, or even electroconvulsive shock therapy, right? It's outside of that. So I knew the bees had to be there because, one, Sylvia writes extensively about bees later on in her life. And so does Anne Sexton, and bees show up, right? And what a beautiful metaphor. To me, it was a metaphor for mental health in general. Mm-hmm. So the idea that we can cure, we go back to this idea of curing, you know, mental illness, and the idea that in my belief, you really can't, you can just treat it. Well, that's the bees in the bee box. It's, we can try to contain them, but In reality, we can't. They can come and go as they please, and that they only allow us to give, they only give us that perception of being able to contain them. But in reality, we can't. And there's a scene in the book where Sylvia really shows this, that, you know, you can't contain the bees, that the bees will always get out and they will always do what they want to do, just like mental illness will. And ultimately, it's what it does to Sylvia. But yeah, that key moment for me when I was writing the book, I was like, I think that's the symbol.
So yeah, it's funny, as I reflect back on I don't know if you got an MFA, but as I reflect back on your educational path, it almost occurs to me that maybe getting a degree in psychology and mm-hmm. studying mental health would be more useful than getting an MFA.
Well, you know what the truth is? I got an MFA, but an untraditional one. I didn't do it through university. I knew that I always wanted to be a writer. So I went to go work in book publishing. Mm-hmm. And I worked alongside my absolute favorite authors on the planet. And even ones that I didn't know at the time, who became my absolute favorite authors on the planet. And so I got to actually learn through them how they did it. I understood the mechanics. I understood the heavy lifting of storytelling. But years and years earlier, I met Carl Bernstein at a conference. And Carl Bernstein, I was a little kid. No, I was maybe 16 or 17. And I walked up to him and was like, Carl, I'm Mr. Bernstein. I want to be at the time I was like, I want to be a journalist. And you know, what school should I go to? And he looked at me dead serious. He goes, don't go to journalism school, kid. And I was like, okay. And he's like, if you want to be a writer, don't go to school to be a writer. And I thought that was like awful advice at the time. And I didn't know how to interpret that. But here I am in New York working in book publishing. I was at Penguin Books and Harcourt, and then what became Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And I didn't know what to write. I knew how to write. I just didn't know what to write. And that was a major problem. So I went back to school and became a therapist, right? I got my psychology degree, my master's degree in psychology. And guess what? Now I know what I need to write. Now I know how to write and what to write about. So as soon as I got my master's and my degree and my credentials, I put those behind it and became a writer.
Yeah. Now you have to tell us who your favorite authors are. Who were you studying with?
Oh my gosh. So Jan Martel was one of mine. Gunter Grass was one of mine. I worked alongside Michael Chabon, Jonathan Latham. Gosh, I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. Gary Steingart was one of mine. Right after he did the Russian Debutante's Handbook. So I worked with him on Absurdistan. And so, you know, all of these things, Glenn David Gould, Andrew Sean Greer, Richard Powers was in the circle. I didn't work with him, but I followed him around quite a bit. So, oh gosh, there was Matt Haig, who wound up becoming hugely famous. You know, you name it, Peter Heller. So all of these sort of writers who were just kind of coming of age and getting their work out there. Philip Roth I worked with him briefly. And so each of these sort of informed the kind of writer I wanted to be. I came to understand tension, voice, desire, need, moral need, psychological need, symbolism, diversity of ideas, the story shape, whether it's linear or spiral shaped, or explosive. I learned about, you know, different ways of getting a story across. Do you want to do an epistolary sort of story with letters, or do you want to do it very straightforward? I learned how to write as though every character has a limp, right? Mm-hmm. Every character has a flaw. And so all of those things sort of just were in my bones.
How do you envision this, the structure of this, as you're talking about the explosive versus the linear versus the circular? Her name just flew out of my head right now, but the spiral, the woman who wrote about the different ways to imagine structure beyond the traditional structure. Did you have that kind of visual patterning in your head when you were organizing this?
I did. I write very visually. So I have to understand how everything works, almost in concentric circles or a Venn diagram where each, you know, storyline sort of briefly touches and then moves on into its own sphere. So I very, very much do. I've started projects and put them away because I can't see the shape of the story. So I tend to always start from that visual place. The book that I picked up that I think really hammered all this home was John Truby. Truby, you know, I think I have it here. It's The Art of Story. The Anatomy of Story. Yeah. The Anatomy of Story is a book that I have memorized. I eat and breathe and drink. I think every point that he makes in his deconstruction and construction of story is what makes my favorite writers writers. And you know what doesn't work. If something's not working, you can go right into that book and you can figure it out real quick why it's not working at all. Some of the, you know, the books that come out today, I don't find as tight. I find them more meandering. And I can tell you right away, just based on, you know, the Anatomy of Story, why these stories aren't working for me. I'm sure they work for other people just fine. But, you know, when I'm constructing my books, especially with this last one, because it's basically three different novels sort of spun together. Each beat within my novel, within each storyline, corresponds with the other. So if you lined them up, you would actually see, okay, here's the rising action in this story, and here's the rising action in that story, and here's the rising action in the third story. Here's the revelation. And you know, so each beat within each story has a revelation. Here's the second revelation. And here's where we're introducing the moral need and the psychological need, all within the same beat. So you could line it up. And so that's what I did. But I'll tell you, before I had the shape of the book, before I had the shape of the narrative, it was like a star that had exploded. I couldn't figure it out at all.
I will say that usually books that are told in three different points of view, there's always somebody who I'm like, I can't wait to get back to that person. That didn't happen this time. I mean, I was equally happy and delighted every time Ruth came by versus Boston came by. And that's really unusual. I mean, usually I'm just waiting for an essay.
Honestly, thank you so much. You know, I really appreciate you saying that. I really tried to make that to be the case. I wanted each story, I wanted you to be able to come back to it. And the idea was that you're seeing the same story told over different generations with different plot points, but we're all thematically combined. And if you lose the momentum in one storyline, the whole book was going to fall apart. I mean, I can't tell you how many books, which I still love, but, you know, I get to, you know, somebody else's storyline and it just feels like it's hard to get through that. And I really wanted to make sure that each of these characters had something to say that moved the storyline forward from scene to scene.
Yep. Did we leave out any advice? We covered a lot. Is there other advice that you give out?
Yeah, you hit a lot of it. You know what my advice is? Somebody told me a long time ago, and it's true. Write with your shoes on. Write with your shoes on. If you come to work every day with your shoes on, you sit down to write, it becomes a job. And I mean that in the best way possible. Don't do it wearing your pajamas. You know, treat it like the profession that it is. I came at this. I mean, maybe it's because I came at it from the perspective of working in a publishing house where it's work, but you never show up to work wearing slippers. Although with the pandemic, sure, why not, right? But, you know, every day I come in, I bring my kids to school. I put my shoes on. I come into my office. I do a little Mr. Rogers sort of, you know, put my sweater on. And I sit down and I work. The advice that I got early on from one of my early mentors, because I asked her straight up, what's the difference between you who've written many novels and someone like me who wants to be a novelist? And she looked at me and she just said, you just got to write the damn book. And she was right. And so I've never looked back. And every day I sit down and work and put my shoes on.
That's the first time I've heard the put your shoes on advice. I really like that. I did have a writing professor at some point who, she had a home office, so she wasn't going out, and she would put on pearls and a silk yeah. blouse, same thing, you know, she would get dressed up to go into her second bedroom.
I have to say, I think that's so wonderful. I think that there was a movie that came out a couple of years ago. It was based on a novel about magicians and illusionists. And one of the tricks, the illusion was, how was it that, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. It was something like, there was an old man who was this magician, who was this old man who would perform these crazy tricks, and he would wander around. He was stooped over and he'd hobble, and he'd come up on stage and do these amazing, amazing tricks. And then he'd disappear. And that was his thing. And you find out that the way that he was able to do all these magic tricks is that he was not an old man, but he was actually a very young man dressed as an old man who would always go out in character. And so he was constantly always in character, always dressed for the part, even though that was not who he really was in real life. And that's, in order for the illusion to work, he had to maintain this illusion, you know, dress the part his whole life. And I think that's probably true with any sort of craft. You've got to actually dress the part and act the part and do, you know, and live it and breathe it every single day. And, you know, I think that your writing professor wearing pearls and putting that, you know, the silk on is absolutely wonderful, because it is, it's, you're putting on that uniform.
How do we find you? I want to make sure everybody knows where to go. And if you're doing online events, I don't know, we can follow you around.
Thank you. Yeah. So it's a weird time, right? Because everybody's doing things on virtual. I am. So probably the best place to find me is www.leekravitz.com. It's KRAVETZ.com. And you'll have my tour schedule and just sort of updates and things like that. And you can always, my contact information is there, so you can reach me through that as well. And yeah, I'm going to be appearing a lot of different places over the next couple of months. So I'd love to see people and meet people, some in person even.
The best news that you gave us is that you're just turning straight to fiction. So that means we can talk again, because
oh my God,
that's what we do here. So I'm just going to sit here and wait.
Would you mind? Yeah. Just, you know, give me a couple more months and then we'll, no, it sounds great. I would love this. I love talking about this. I love talking about craft. I love talking about, like I call it, the nuts and bolts of writing. You know, I think it's wonderful that, you know, the finished product works, and it, you know, the novel works, and that people are, you know, sort of picking it up. But it's the stuff behind the scenes that I absolutely love. That's probably why, you know, I started writing about Sylvia Plath to begin with. I was like, I want to know who made Sylvia Plath. You know, how did she find her voice, and, you know, what was going on behind the scenes there? So Yeah, anytime. I love talking about this.
Yeah, well, you came to the right place. That's what we do here. Lee Kravitz, thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Lee Kravitz. The book is The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. You can find this and other episodes on our websites. Barbara's is barbaradeMarcoBarrett.com. Mine is mariestone.com. Or you can subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, and Stitcher. Music, sound design, and editing provided by Travis Barrett. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.